This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support.
Man, that one goes deep. Kevin, you took me to church on that one.
Thank you.
Beautiful, beautiful singing. Hey, folks, you're in for a treat. This is Bill McLaughlin, and you have tuned in by good fortune or intentionally to Post Classical. We have the usual cast with us in the studio. We got our brains over there, Joe Horowitz, and next to me is my favorite conductor, who's not me, Angel Gil Ordóñez. Great to see both of you guys back here.
Great to be here.
Wonderful singer. Kevin Dace. Joe, what were we just listening to?
This is Harry Burley's arrangement of Steal Away, performed by Kevin Dace at the Washington National Cathedral at a concert produced by Post Classical Ensemble called The Trumpet Shall Sound. And I'm proud to say it's my good fortune, my great good fortune, to have accompanied Kevin for about a dozen years now. Mm. I was the pianist. We've performed in elementary schools, middle schools, high schools, colleges, universities, conservatories, concert halls, and on this occasion for a vast interracial audience in the great nave of the National Cathedral in D.C.
Tell us about Harry Burley. You mentioned his name.
He is yet another forgotten hero in the little-known history of classical music in America. His dates are 1866 to 1949. Burley was Dvorak's assistant at the National Conservatory in New York, 1892 to 1895. Mm-hmm. And it was his singular achievement to be the person who brought spirituals into the concert hall as art songs. Hmm. So if you ever heard Marian Anderson or Paul Robeson sing Deep River, that is Burley's Deep River. Hmm. And it is a high creative achievement, as is Steal Away, which we just heard.
1866, Erie, Pennsylvania. Might sound like a strange place for a young black kid to be born. That's 1 year after the war, by which I mean the Civil War. I'm guessing his folks who had been slaves.
His grandfather.
Did they arrive in Erie as part of the Underground Railroad? Because it was right across the lake from Canada. That would have been one of the escape routes, I'm thinking.
His father purchased his freedom. Huh. And went north. He didn't have to escape. He actually paid to be freed some ridiculously small amount of money. He was blind. He was the lamplighter in Erie. Mm-hmm. And he sang, making his rounds, accompanied by his two grandsons. Mm-hmm. And that is how Harry heard the sorrow songs.
These old, beautiful songs. I remember some years ago, I was in the Lincoln Center Library, and I came across this book of these spirituals as set by Harry Burley. It was full of all kinds of useful instruction. He said, now look, I'm going to put it in my own words. He said, I'm writing in what's essentially a slightly different language, a dialect from American music, what you're used to hearing. So if I say these or them or those, he said, don't overdo it. Make them sound as natural as you can be. But if I wrote these and them and those, that's not what the people were singing. So Kevin, you're a highly trained singer. You went to Juilliard, for heaven's sakes. How do you approach these wonderful old songs?
I try to approach them as simply and earnestly as possible. Uh-huh. I feel that especially with the Burley arrangements, there is simplicity in their structure. He has license to do a few different things every once in a while, kind of adding a seven or a nine.
Just before the end, there's a flat six chord there. It comes straight out of Wagner, doesn't it, Joe? We were laughing about that a little bit.
His harmonic vocabulary is chromatic and sophisticated, even though he didn't formally study composition. For instance, he could not compose for orchestra. Mm. There was nothing by Burley for orchestra. Uh-huh. But he really picked up a very sophisticated command of chromatic harmony.
And somehow he's able to blend it without losing authenticity.
Sure, right.
It still stays.
Angel, you're coming from a completely different culture, nationally, musically. How do these spirituals affect you?
Well, very deeply, because I feel that they are profoundly spiritual. And this is actually what attracts me to them. Mm. I don't see any difference between those spirituals or a Bruckner motet. Mm. is the same approach, because in the end, it's this depth mm-hmm. that we are looking for there.
They are beautiful. Later in his life, Harry Burley worked as a church singer mm-hmm. in a very fancy church in New York, right up to the day he died. But the really, really important gift I think he gave us all was during those years when he met Antoni Dvorak at this amazing school which Mrs. Thurber got going, which, number one, allowed boys and girls to go to school together, and number two, really staggering, black and white kids could go to school together. That's how he was there. And it was there that Dvorak, who was very interested in American folk music, heard him sing these spirituals.
It's a hard story to get your head around. What is the likelihood that this famous Bohemian composer teaching in New York would choose a black young man as his assistant? That's not a coincidence. Obviously, he liked hearing Burley sing those spirituals, but I think it was also an act of conscience because Dvorak was a great humanitarian. And I think his inspiration, the inspiration that he exerted on Burley when he validated and said the songs and he said, "This is as great as any music I have ever heard." We will tell this story over the next 2 hours. But that leads to Burley's Deep River. That leads to Burley's Steal Away. Had Dvorak not validated those songs as a pedigreed outside observer, would Burley have pushed so hard? And we'll talk about that, why and when he did it.
You know, I'm thinking for a young kid studying composition in those years, the 1890s, and here's Dvorak, this famous composer, coming in to teach you, and you say, "Man, I want to learn to compose just like you, or if not you, like your friend Brahms, or if not that, then Liszt or Wagner or something like that." And Dvorak said, He said, "You have to write your own music." He said, "There are beautiful songs from all over the world here in America, Scotch songs, Irish songs, Italian songs." He said, "And these Negro spirituals are profoundly beautiful." I got a question. Do you guys know when that word came into common use, Negro spirituals?
Anyone I do not.
I've known them all my life and love them. I wonder what they call them that during the Civil
War period. They're typically called the sorrow songs or plantation songs.
Right, because there was a sort of mixed blackface culture going on all over America from the time of Stephen Foster. That's before the Civil War. And there was a mix of stuff. But to take this stuff out in front and put it on a concert stage and sing, like, "This is beautiful music. Just sit there and hear it." Something.
You don't see the word spirituals. You see plantation song, sorrow song.
Very interesting. Well, we got a lot of music on today. I want to hear some more. Where are we going to go next?
Another one of Kevin's best numbers. I'll let him talk about it if I shut up. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. What's interesting about this is that we violate the ending, and I'll tell you why. This is Burley talking about spirituals. Their worth is weakened unless they are done impressively. For through all these songs there breathes a hope, a faith in the ultimate justice and brotherhood of man. The cadences of sorrow invariably turn to joy, and the message is ever manifest that eventually deliverance from all that hinders and oppresses the soul will come, and man, every man, will be free. So Burley wrote that in 1917. It paraphrases W.E.B. Du Bois in his famous essay on the sorrow songs in the souls of black folk. And what this means, among other things, is that he always modulates to the major. I don't know if it's my fault, but Kevin and I can never get ourselves behind the jubilant songs. We prefer, or at least I do, their sorrow songs. And this is a song, "Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child," where he typically modulates into the major, and we change the ending and leave it in the minor, don't we?
Yes, we do. It just seems like it's too late to introduce that kind of bright harmonic color after you've been in this mode of lament, basically.
Yeah. I can see, though, for Burley, I won't call it sugarcoating, but you have a little brightness for this audience. They don't know these tunes.
Yes.
I mean, some folks did if they grew up in a neighborhood where there were people singing these old slave songs, but most Americans did not know them. So you got to kind of give like them something to make them feel comfortable.
Exactly. A little happy ending.
So let's take the happy ending away. Let's listen. Is this with you again, Joe, playing piano?
It's the same concert, and I am the pianist.
"Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child."
"Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I..."
Beautiful. Kevin Days, Joe Horowitz at the piano. Kevin, I'm just curious, just before the end, it happens a couple times in the song, there's a little turn in the melody that I don't know.
That's my own interpolation.
Was it?
Yes.
It's brilliant.
I just think there's so much repetition in it that it just needs that slight variant to maybe keep the ear a little more connected.
That's wonderful.
Thank you.
You know what caught my mind in this song immediately? First of all, there's a kind of rhythm set up. It's a kind of a lullaby. It's a terribly sad lullaby. But the rhythm of the piano at the beginning and the harmonic stuff could almost come from someone like Delius. Can we hear just a little bit of the opening right up to the spot where Kevin comes in the first time? Listen to this kind of rocking rhythm that's in the piano and then how it goes into the spiritual. Yeah, it's beautiful. That little thing, it's not what you expect harmonically, is it, Joe? And it belongs to something else, like French composer Delius Debussy, or even Vaughan Williams when he's making folk song, that running back and forth.
Delius was sitting on the porch of the orange plantation that he tended in Florida when he heard the voices of African Americans singing in the distance.
Uh-huh.
And that's when he became a composer. That music infuses his entire style.
Interesting. Very interesting. Beautiful setting. Wonderful singing again from Kevin Days.
Thank you.
And now we got a really big name. I'm a Philadelphian, and I didn't need to be a Philadelphian to love Marian Anderson, but I'm really, really proud of her no matter what.
Of course.
Let's listen now to Marian Anderson and ask the question of how she came to be singing this arrangement by Harry Burley.
So this is the seminal arrangement. This is Deep River, 1917. He's already 51 years old.
Gotcha.
It's the first spiritual he sets. And it is an instantaneous sensation. And within a year, it's being widely sung by white recitalists, because all the recitalists are white. These are famous opera singers, and they're singing Burley's Deep River, and eventually it lands in the lap of Marian Anderson and Paul Robeson. So this is the famous recording that she made of Deep River, Burley's Deep River, that we're about to hear.
Kills you.
Amazing. It's so beautiful.
Remember when you first heard that recording as a little kid, Kevin?
I think actually it's since I've been working with Joe that I've actually sat and listened to it. My first exposure to Marian Anderson was singing the Erbarmadich from the St. Matthew Passion.
Which is also killing.
Just amazing. And the same kind of spirituality, which is how we based our program.
You know, and I thought the tempo that the two of you took on Motherless Child was really slow. Nothing like the tempo here.
Yes.
How did they sustain it? Well, it takes a fantastic singer to sustain it, but it takes the imagination that you can keep the audience there.
That's right.
So that is, you were calling these sorrow songs, Joe.
Yeah.
That's a sorrowful version, but beautiful and healing at the same time.
Her phrasing is just amazing. I mean, you have no question about the direction of the phrase and her sustaining of her tone. But one thing I noticed this time for the first time is that she rolled her R. And that's a very formal kind of diction to use in a spiritual.
People might not know what that is. That's kind of singer talk.
It's,
show us.
Well, river, overjoyed Just a little bit. Not a lot of flips, but enough to sound, to have a role in the sound.
Interesting.
And to me, that kind of puts this into that more formal of African-American music tradition.
Yeah. But Joe, you told us before we started going on the air, this wasn't always such a slow song. What's the history of Deep River?
As Kevin knows, I like these songs as slow as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And we often have friendly disagreements about tempo, because I'm completely inconsiderate. I'm playing the piano. I can play as slow as I want. What's amazing is this began as an upbeat spiritual. We know this from a music historian named Wayne Shirley, and it's his wonderful article, The Coming of Deep River, that fostered our show, which we call Deep River, The Art of the Spiritual, which we've now done maybe four or five times. It's next going this season to Virginia Tech. We know that the Fisk Jubilee Singers, we'll hear it in a moment because Angel reconstructed it, did an upbeat version that was obscure. It was not a popular spiritual. The next thing that happened was that Samuel Coleridge Taylor, a famous, once famous black British composer, came upon this spiritual in the Fisk songbook, not harmonized, and decided it was the most beautiful of all the spirituals.
Mm.
He's the first person to slow it down.
So he's just looking at the music. There's no tempo marking in that little book, right?
You can tell.
Say Allegro, no.
When it says, oh, I want to cross over into Camp Town, you know it's not slow.
Hmm.
Right?
I don't know. Angel might show us something a little bit different in a minute, but we'll get to hear
that. We'll get to hear that in a moment. So Coleridge Taylor is 1905.
Right.
He slows it down. It's a piano piece. It's very uneven as a piano piece. And it's in 1917 that we get really a perfect rendering of Deep River by Burley, which, as it were, is a perfection and compression of the Coleridge Taylor Deep River, inspired by the Largo from the New World Symphony by Dvorak.
Hmm.
We're now going to go through this story in detail.
Okay.
But the kicker is Burley composed this.
Mm-hmm.
It's really not an arrangement. Ask Angel, he'll tell you.
Well, the interesting thing is that the song works beautifully, both fast and slow.
Huh.
This is Haydn. Haydn was the one that said, when you are playing a slow movement is when you can use difficult harmonies and modulate.
I see what you mean.
So the way to make this song work is what I try to do, which is just using tonica as dominant.
Simple harmonies, because it's gone by fast to adjust to or
hear
everything
else.
Yeah.
It works beautifully. I mean, not because I wrote it, but that's the reason. And then this is the magic of Harry Borlaug and the other composers, that then they create complex harmonies, and then you need much more time to really appreciate the whole thing. And this is the magic of the arrangement of Burley and of the piece. And this is what we somehow present to the audience.
Okay, which version are we going to hear right now?
Well, we should now talk about the Fisk Jubilee Singers.
Who's Fisk? What's Fisk about?
Fisk is a university in Nashville. It exists to this day.
Uh-huh.
It's for African Americans. And there still is a singing group there that tours called the Fisk Jubilee Singers. But back in the 19th century, this is the most famous black choral group touring with spirituals, which is to say, Bill, that before Burley, if you heard spirituals in concert, it would be an a cappella African-American choral group. They were famous internationally. Mark Twain, a music lover who knew Wagner and Schubert, said the most stirring music he ever heard was when he heard the Fisk Jubilee Singers, and he became friendly with them when they came to England, which is where he was living at the time.
Hmm.
And they left an early recording of Swing Low. And if we listen to it, we'll hear what their harmonic vocabulary was like and why Angel, when he reconstructed from a melody line the Fisk Deep River, didn't use chromatic harmony. So this is the Fisk Jubilee recording from 1909.
Wow.
Of their version of Swing Low, Sweet Chariot.
Can't wait.
Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for the Academy home. Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for the Academy home. I'm sometimes up and I'm carry me home, England, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. If you get there before I do, coming for to carry me
I'm hearing right away, Joe, is that it's sort of a call and response form, which is, man, it's all over jazz. It's all over hip hop, for that matter. It's still there.
It's in the cotton fields where there's one guy singing and the other
solo
responding.
Singer, and then the chorus sings a lot of long tones supporting him and then responds to him, call and response.
I'm so glad you say that, because this is what I used also. I think that's essential, exactly what you said. And we'll talk about that later. And that this is absolutely essential. That's a very important point we're making.
So now we're going to go to Angel's arrangement. Again, the Fifth Songbook, this is such an obscure spiritual that they didn't even leave a harmonized version. Mm-hmm. All we have is the melody and the words, and Angel harmonized it in the Fisk diatonic style, and it sounds like this.
Well, bravo. That's a sporty version of it, isn't it? You know what that reminds me of a lot? When I was a kid, there were all these choirs touring. I'm talking about largely white college choirs. Oh, Temple University had a terrific choir with some great black singers like the Simpson Sisters and Gwen Killebrew in it. But it was really a white choir singing spirituals. And those kids loved to sing it. Bob Page loved to conduct them. And a lot of things were up-tempo like this. You know, like that train going to come again, and that sort of thing. That train is bound for glory. They love that kind of stuff. You caught that brilliantly.
Well, thank you.
You Spaniard in the new world.
Just part of it. I love that.
That's fantastic. And you do use call and response throughout that. It's brilliant. What fun. Who was singing just then?
This is a wonderful choir of the Washington National Cathedral that collaborated with us on a regular basis. As you know, we are now the resident orchestra there at the cathedral. And of course, we want to give credit to Mike McCarthy, the music director of the choir.
They sing it with wonderful spirit. It's a whole different version. It's not a sorrow song there. It's upbeat.
Yes, it's underwent a fundamental transformation, as I said, beginning with Coleridge Taylor in 1905. And then Maud Powell took Coleridge Taylor's Deep River and turned it into a piece for violin and piano, which is to say Coleridge Taylor transcribed it for violin and piano. And she made a recording. She is the first white artist to record a spiritual. Hmm. We're talking about the most famous American violinist of her generation, who happened to be a woman.
What period is that, Joe?
This recording is from 1911.
Wow. So it's just a couple of years after the Fisk Jubilee version that we heard.
No, the Fisk songbook in question is from the 1870s.
But the version we heard recorded was 1909, you said.
That's correct. It's 2 years after that Swing Low. You can easily access it on YouTube. You won't hear the whole thing, but you'll understand that Coleridge Taylor has slowed it down.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen. That ain't no Deep River. I don't know what that was. Was that Coleridge then?
That's Coleridge Taylor's.
But there's an earlier spot. I was following the hymn tune or the spiritual tune, and it takes a turn to the minor. And that was also music I've never heard before. Was that also?
That's all Coleridge Taylor's interpolation. My version of this story is that it starts with Dvorak. Dvorak validates these songs as source material for a concert. And then Coleridge Taylor, he gets a talking to. Du Bois is talking to him, Burley is talking to him, and they're telling him, you're the guy, you're going to do it. And he does. So in 1905, he composes these 24, quote, Negro melodies for solo piano. And I feel certain that at some point, Harry Burley said, you know, I can do it better. And he hadn't yet done it at all. Mm-hmm. And he could do it better. He could do it much better. The linkage goes circling right back to Dvorak. All these guys talk about Dvorak as an inspiration. But when Burley does Deep River, we know he's inspired by the Largo from the New World Symphony, because one of his versions, which we're about to hear, which is the male a cappella version, begins by citing the opening of the Largo of the New World Symphony. So What we do when we produce this show is that Ankel will first conduct the SATB, Burley Deep River, which is a masterpiece, then the little-known TTBB, all-male a cappella Deep River, where he cites Dvorak, and then Kevin will sing Goin' Home, which is an adaptation by William Arms Fisher, also a student of Dvorak, of De Largo. Another component of this amazing story is that the publisher of the Coleridge Taylor 24 Negro Melodies was William Arms Fisher, the same former Dvorak student who turned De Largo into Goin' Home.
De Largo you speak of is a slow movement of the New World Symphony.
So you can see that there's this coterie of protégés of Antonín Dvorak who, long after Dvorak's death, are conspiring to fulfill his prophecy.
Let's listen. But you better give us the rundown again, because it's, what, three or four pieces?
This is going to be a long sequence.
So give us the versions.
Ankel's going to conduct Burley Deep River for mixed chorus.
Right.
A masterpiece. Ankel's going to conduct the all-male Deep River.
Right.
And we'll hear Burley allude to Dvorak.
So that's number two.
And then Kevin, with chorus, conducted by Ankel, is going to sing Goin' Home, which is William Arms Fisher's adaptation of De Largo of the New World Symphony.
Got it? Let's listen, folks.
Thank you.
You hear the audience at the National Cathedral in Washington respond to the beautiful singing from Kevin Days once again. I'm curious, who made up those words for Dvorak's Largo? Does anyone know?
William Arms Fisher, former Dvorak student, the man who published Coleridge Taylor's 24 Negro Melodies. And I can tell you the year. It was 1922.
Okay. So that version we hear was the third of three settings, all having to do with the tune Deep River and Dvorak. And that was a large crowd. Kevin, tell us, where were you in the church as you sang that?
Well, we all started in the very front of the church, mm-hmm. and then we walked down the nave. Mm-hmm. I led the group, I believe, or maybe one of the other choirs led the group. That's an incredible space to sing in acoustically and just knowing the history of that edifice. It was such a thrill just to have that space as my own acoustical space to sing in and then to be joined by these younger and older singers all together.
Whom were we hearing there in the chorus?
Well, we had four choruses. So we had the Washington National Cathedral Chorus, we had the Wilson High School Chorus, mm-hmm. we had the Eastern High School Chorus, and we had the Metropolitan AMA Church Chorus too. So it was a display of voices.
Wonder.
And we want to actually acknowledge too that the arrangement of this piece was done by Mike McCarthy, the music director of the Washington National Cathedral.
I got one final question. I can imagine you, Kevin, walking down with all these wonderful singers. That's a great idea. Going home, we're taking it right to you, folks, coming at you. Where were you standing when you were conducting?
Well, so Mike was conducting one of the groups, too, and I was conducting the main, all the students. But what I wanted to mention is that by now we realize the genius of Borley as a composer and the way he harmonized, the two versions we heard, this, the mixed choir, first Deep River, and the second version with the
just men's chorus. That's the one that really caught my imagination. That sounded very
amazing.
Yeah.
And you know, what is fascinating to me is that he saves the most dramatic and most chromatic and beautiful part for the end, always. Mm. And this is, it's really incredible.
Beautiful performances on how Kevin, spectacular singing.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
Music making. And now, Joe, before the show started, you said you wanted to talk about cultural appropriation. It's a music show, man. How do you talk about cultural appropriation? I'm not even sure I can say it.
It's the elephant in this little room who's joined us now. He's come in the door.
Uh-huh.
It's the inescapable topic of the day. Some people will write Burley off as an Uncle Tom because he sanitized the spirituals. He brought them into a white milieu. He aspired to even perhaps elevate them by bringing them into a white concert hall. This debate became explicit during the Harlem Renaissance. I brought along some quotes, which we may or may not have time for. So we're going to talk about this by way of introducing Sir Michael Tippett, because mm-hmm. Tippett is one of the most distinguished white composers who appropriated the spirituals.
And he's English, for heaven's sake.
But
Sir Michael Tippett.
But even before you get to Tippett, you have to absorb that Burley's arrangements in his day were mainly sung by white soloists and by white choruses, and Burley himself was a member of two white choruses, one at a synagogue and one at a church. It was J.P. Morgan's church. He and J.P. Morgan were friends. He sang at Morgan's funeral. So he does occupy both a black milieu and a very, very white milieu. Kevin, since you're the one black person here in this little cubicle.
Oh, I didn't notice it.
Thank you,
And it's something that we've talked about a lot and that always comes up when we do this program and sometimes stirs controversy. Why don't you take us into the realm of cultural appropriation?
Joe and I have talked about this on different occasions, and I am of a different generation. I grew up in the 60s and the 70s where the message was everyone can do everything, and just because you have a certain color that you're expected to have certain kinds of behavior or be drawn to certain cultural, like the arts and music. I feel that I was pretty blessed because my parents, my dad was in the military, so I grew up in a melted pot, and so I grew up around people of all kinds of ethnicities and mixtures of those ethnicities, and so it never occurred to me that as a black person and as a budding artist that I needed to take a specific direction. I wanted to see what my instrument was inclined to do and to follow that. And so my sound wasn't really right for gospel. I had a bass voice from a very young age, and the kind of visceral singing that I enjoy listening to with gospel music, I didn't feel it was really the right kind of singing for me. And so I was drawn to classical music. And so to think that maybe I was appropriating German Lieder as an African-American would have never occurred to me. Mm. I aspired to get to what I thought was the highest quality of music making by my own perception. And again, no disrespect to other genres, but that's where my voice took me. And so I never questioned the authenticity of my expression in any of these cultures. And I was very happy to come back to the spiritual relatively late in my career and have a new and strong appreciation for the spiritual.
We were following a call of artistry above all.
Yes. That was my only expectation, was to improve my art and to evolve with it.
Joe, you brought up the name Michael Tippett, and I know before we went on the air, Kevin, that you mentioned you've sung Michael Tippett's big piece. Michael Tippett, terrific composer, composed a number of operas, lots of interesting stuff. Not as well known, I would say, as Benjamin Britten, but musicians love his music.
Yes.
You know who really loves his music? I ran into him at Birdley. I went to Ravi Coltrane, great tenor player. He's the son of the great Coltrane. Yeah, we were sitting there. For some reason or another, we both talked about how much we love the opera Midsummer Marriage. Ravi owns the score. And I had seen a live production, which you never had, so we kind of changed. But anyway, so many musicians love the music of Michael Tippett. And the piece we're talking about now is called
Child of Our Time. I'm just thinking while you're talking, Bill, maybe Kevin, you would like to chime in with an opinion. I don't know that a white American composer would have done what Tippett did as a white British composer, which is an oratorio in which the chorales are replaced by his own arrangements of spirituals. Do you have an opinion on that?
I've never heard that. It may exist, but I've, in my experience, have never heard a white American composer make that choice. I sang a lot of oratorios that were written by Dave Brubeck and premiered several of those. But his kind of chorale settings were, again, more in the jazz genre than
Latin
spiritual.
Yes,
his Pasada was performed every year at Fifth Avenue Church, Presbyterian Church. But I think what I love about Tippett, I just performed the A Child of Our Time with the Florida Orchestra down in Tampa in the Tri-City area. I just love that he was so authentic. I mean, he had rich orchestral accompaniments under the spirituals, but somehow, again, his intention was so clear that it still had that authenticity.
So we've been weighing in, and Joe, I see you've brought notes. What have you in your notes there to tell us about this?
Let's just hear how this debate manifested during the decades of the Harlem Renaissance from famous African-American writers and thinkers.
Should we say for youngsters who tuned in when the Harlem Renaissance was? Mm-hmm.
We're talking about the 20s and the 30s.
Right.
And we're going to begin with one of the biggest names, Alain Locke. Like Du Bois, W.E.B. Du Bois, he went to Harvard, and he did not think that white culture was some kind of patriarchal mistake.
Hmm.
So here he is, Take It or Leave It, 1925. He thought that Negro spirituals could undergo intimate and original development in directions already the line of advance in modernistic music. Negro folk song is not midway in its artistic career yet. Imagine he said that. And while the preservation of the original folk forms is for the moment the most pressing necessity, an inevitable art development awaits them, as in the past it has awaited all other great folk music. So he's awaiting this greater development. This is not me, this is Locke, of black music in the white classical forms. Polar opposite, Carl Van Vechten, a white guy.
New York intellectual.
Who deplored the singing of Roland Hayes, famous black tenor, because he thought it was hyper-refined. And then we get to Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurston. Hughes deplored the, quote, race toward whiteness in the uses of black music. This is referring now to what Burley did. Hurston deplored a flight from blackness. She heard concert spirituals, quote, squeezing all of the rich black juice out of the songs, a sort of musical octoroon. So there you have, in a nutshell, the two opinions. And Kevin is shaking his head.
I couldn't disagree more. I mean, it's a business model for all of music and most of industry that you want to include as broad a demographic and appreciating it as possible. That's just a marketing model. And so if it happens to be a black music that's somehow a bit more accessible to whites in a structure that maybe they feel more comfortable with, that's a business model. That's a very practical choice to make. You can listen to certain country and Western music, and you can hear how some might think it's not real authentic because it doesn't have a steel guitar in it. But if you look at the CMA Awards now, it's a very close, it's pretty similar to pop music as it is now, the way that it sounds. It's because it's meant to, again, be more marketable. So I think there is a practical side to that.
You know, I have an idea, too, just thinking about this. I like Zora Neale Hurston a lot. I love Mr. Hughes, Langston Hughes, I love. I have a hard time memorizing poetry, but I've taken the trouble to learn some of his. He also wrote some blues, verbal blues. He said, this is my blues. This is what I'm going to sing. It's fantastic because it follows blues form. But I have to say that neither Hurston nor Langston Hughes are musicians. So when they write about music, they're just more voices. They don't actually affect the music the way composers and performers do. And I think that's what you're getting at, Kevin. It's what happens when real musicians get a hold of it. They're going to go where they're going to go, no matter what the philosophies are. You're going to follow what's in your ear and your heart.
Right. And some are going to question its authenticity because it doesn't seem like what they perceive that.
And you know what? Pretty soon those guys will be dead. And
the music
the music will either live or not. And I think it's living. Let's hear, can we get to hear now a little bit of
now
Michael Tippett?
Now we're going to go to the white guy, Michael Tippett. We'll set it up by hearing Burley himself. This is our one recording we have of Burley. His arrangement of Go Down Moses, recorded in 1924 when he was 58, directly followed with Michael Tippett's arrangement of Go Down Moses. This is from the oratorio, we've been talking about A Child of Our Time, only he's extracted his arrangement as an a cappella number for bass and chorus, and Kevin is the bass, and the chorus is the National Cathedral Chorale, conducted by Angel. So we'll hear first Burley, and then Tippett.
When Israel was in Egypt land, let my people go. Pressed so hard they could not stand, let my people go. Go down, Moses, way down in Egypt.
good Moses said, let my people go. If not, I'll smite your firstborn dead. Let my people go. Go down, Moses, way down in Egypt's land. Tell all Pharaoh to let my people go.
Israel was in Egypt land.
Let my people go to Pharaoh.
Oppressed so hard they could not stand.
Let my people.
Thus spake the Lord, bold Moses said,
let my people go Pharaoh.
If not, I smite your firstborn dead.
Let my people go down.
Go down,
Moses,
remarkable to hear that. That's a setting by the English composer Sir Michael Tippett. It's from his oratorio, A Child of Our Time, in which he's employing an old spiritual and remaking it in his own way. That was Kevin Days, once again, as the soloist. We'll tell you about the rest of the performers in a moment. At the beginning of that segment, we heard our man of the hour, Harry Burley, sitting at the piano and accompanying himself. That's an old recording. It was made when he was nearly 60 years old, from the mid-1920s. The only time I've ever heard a live performance of this music, Neville Marriner did it with the Minnesota Orchestra when I was around the Twin Cities. And it was interesting to watch the audience because they knew that there were going to be what they thought of as Negro spirituals. And they all come like, that's bonbons. You know, I like it. I like them. I really like Negro spirituals. These spirituals have about as much relation to the originals as, say, if Picasso looks at a work of Velázquez, mm-hmm. goes away and makes a conjuring on it and makes it into a brand new piece.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You can see all the elements that he's borrowed, but it's very different.
Sure.
Do you think this is successful?
I think it's incredibly successful. Mm-hmm. I think it is. I think it's a beautiful appropriation of extraordinary material.
And in a way, Joe, that goes in with the people you were reading us from the Harlem Renaissance worrying about whether we could take this. It's such a vexed word. I'm going to call it Negro music because that's what they were calling it in 1924. And that was a respectful way to refer to it.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to take this Negro music and have it develop as art form always has. That's the line that you gave us, right?
And Elaine Locke says modernistic music.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like it or not, you don't have to like it, but we just heard precisely fulfills what Du Bois and Locke want to see happen.
Yep.
Right.
It's interesting, in the piece, the oratorio, A Child of Our Time, all of the other movements are really written much more in the modern style mm-hmm. of writing, very jagged rhythms mm-hmm. and very dissonant. In fact, when we did our performances, the audience, you know, you're kind of taking through these movements, again, that are really challenging. And this is a Southern audience, too, in Florida. You could see people just really kind of melt back into their seats because there was something so familiar now that they could grasp onto. And it's really moving.
We have a lot more music to listen to, so we're going to take a station break right now. And you have a tune we can listen to as we go out, right, Joe?
This is another famous Burley choral arrangement conducted by Angel at the National Cathedral. My Lord, What a Morning.
Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with Post Classical. Once again, with Kevin Days, Joe Horowitz, and Angel. We'll be right back.